Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today we're broadcasting from the International Culinary Center in Soho, New York. And I am very happy, I am always happy to welcome back a tremendous grad of ours. And today we have one who's come in from Washington, D.C., and I think we have a very unique show lined up for us today. Ed Hardy, who is a graduate of culinary from 07, is from Washington, D.C., and he's the king of the food trucks down there right now. But more importantly, he's been named one of the top 10 D.C. chefs to watch in 2016. So I'm going to watch him through this whole interview. But he's a native of Virginia, so that's nice for your home roots. And but he's got a great background, nothing less than working with Marcus Samuelson, and he also worked with the Union Square Hospitality Group here in New York, but then went back to D.C., was named the executive chef of Bon Vivant, and then went to Quench in Rockville, Maryland. He then got into his food trucks, which we'll get into, Bacon and Ed's, in 2014. I like that name. Anyway, welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Dorothy. It's nice to be here.
So, you're a Virginia guy. You went to UVA?
I went to UVA.
But let's go back before
sure.
that. Where in Virginia? How rural? How urban? Because Virginia, you never know.
Sure. I'm from Richmond, and my family's been from Richmond for a while.
Oh, really? You're a Southern Belle.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I grew up in all the finest, you know, sort of old, you know, aristocratic Southern traditions.
They have a great hotel there, right? In a very...
Yeah, the Jefferson.
I stayed there a couple years ago.
The staircase was the basis for the staircase in Gone with the Wind.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they used to have alligators in the lobby.
Wow.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
By design?
By design, yeah.
Whoa. And I very famous colonial people stayed there, and anyway, when I was reading the history,
you can't throw a stone in Richmond without hitting history,
right?
So, you know, surrounded by history growing up, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that so what was your childhood like? Was it food oriented or not?
No, it wasn't. Although that's up for debate, but I was suburban Richmond, you know, upper middle class. A loving mother and father, a older sister, a younger brother.
This sounds dysfunctional.
Yeah. No.
From a chef. I mean, I hear so many stories, but that's wonderful.
Well, the thing is that what I'm kind of My informal study of the chef industry leads me to believe that a lot more boring middle class folks are entering into the ranks, a la Christina Tosi and Missy Robbins and Michael Anthony and all those.
That's right. Isn't Christina from Virginia?
Christina, I believe, went to UVA like me.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe that's the connection.
But I believe she's from Northern Virginia as well.
Yeah, she might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's been on the show. But okay, so tell me. So what? It sounds like a bucolic childhood.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was. Just me sort of being an iconoclast nerd in school.
What were your favorite subjects?
History.
Oh. Aptly.
Yeah, I would finish my work in fourth grade and I'd just read the encyclopedia for fun,
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Any sports in your past?
A lot of swimming.
Oh.
And a little dabbling in basketball and tennis and whatnot, but just a lot of swimming.
Were you a big music guy?
Yes. Yes, I was. I played trombone all throughout high school and middle school.
Were you in the band?
And college. Yes, I was in the band.
What is that like to be? Being a Brooklyn girl, we didn't have any bands. And certainly, I would never have the figure to be a majorette. So what was...
I disagree, Dorothy, but...
what was it like to be in the band?
Kinda as popular culture depicts it. You're told that you're a band nerd, so you are one. Which is nice because you've got a whole bunch of ready-made friends that you can count on and you make music with and are going to be friends for the rest of your life.
Really?
Yeah.
How many days a week did you practice?
Like 6 days a week during the high season, because you're doing marching band, and.
Did you like? How do you march and play the trombone at the same time?
Very, very carefully.
And you have to read the music too.
No, you memorize the music.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you get used to it. It's a lot like culinary in that you don't think that you can put that knife that close to your fingers, and chop tiny slices of garlic at 1,000 RPM a minute, but you can do that, And normal humans look at. Trombone players and say, how do they do that? How do they know where the positions are on the slide to make the correct notes? And it doesn't matter. You just you learn and you do it.
And it has to become second nature?
It becomes second nature. It just becomes muscle memory, which, again, mm-hmm. is just like cooking.
That's true. So, and I guess the brigade, the team, the hierarchy. Is there? There must be a hierarchy in the band.
There is a hierarchy. There are sous chefs, or section leaders. There are, there's the executive chef. There's the band director. Yeah.
Did you play some exciting places and marched in?
No. But once I get to college, I kind of have an interesting history.
Oh. Well, UVA is, interesting in itself.
UVA had a alternative kind of band where we didn't just march up and down. We would form the other school's SAT score on the field, and then, yeah, and then play some song, entitled like "You're So Stupid" or something, and stuff like that.
Whoa! How many people in the band in high school? How many people in the band in college?
100 in high school, 120 in college, and they're my best friends. And in my 9-year undergrad career at UVA,
your parents were indulgent.
My parents forced me into cooking because they didn't want to pay for 9 years of undergrad for some reason. I can't stand them. I hate them. Unbelievable.
Wait, what do you mean they forced you into cooking?
Well, I mean, because they didn't want to pay for 9 years of undergrad at UVA.
So I
had to pay for the second half of my college.
I said, why did it take you so long?
I lacked focus. I didn't, I was busy screwing around doing extracurricular stuff, playing in the band, writing for the daily student newspaper.
Those were good things.
Anything but going to class. And I was the coolest guy who got invited to all the parties.
Wait a minute. So you went from nerd in high school
yes.
to coolest guy in college.
Something clicked. I mean, and not the coolest guy, just the guy that you wanted to invite to the party because he was fun.
Okay, so tell me what kind of fun things. Was it humor? Was
it was
pranks?
Humor. And the humor part comes from being the middle child, because you have to do something to be noticed.
Uh-huh.
And my dad was funny. My dad had a solid basis of humor. He made my mom laugh, and that's primarily what my role was as well in the family, was to make mom laugh. And
she was a lucky woman.
Well, Yeah.
I mean, to have, you know, they say humor is the thing that a marriage should be based on. So.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah.
The good ones.
So, but was it, do you have a quick wit or a, is it, you know, you could tell good jokes or?
This is, no, I've developed good comedic timing.
Uh-huh.
I discovered this when I was introducing somebody on stage for, like, I was president of some, you know, of some do-gooder thing in high school, and I realized I was making people laugh just through the pauses, and I realized this is a thing. This is something I can pursue.
That is a real talent.
But I grew up, again, under the influence of my dad, but also I wrote a humor column in high school. I've written, you know, flippant pieces ever since, you know, for like Food Republic and other outlets.
Do you enjoy writing?
I do enjoy writing. It's I'm my own harshest critic, but when the words come, they come, and I find that I'm still able to do it. I mean, that was one of my three careers that I've had was as a journalist. Yeah. And as kind of a PR copywriter, I did a little speech writing on the Hill. If you get to my political career, yeah.
Okay. Well, all right. We haven't gotten there yet. So tell me, other than taking 9 years, how old were you? 30 when you graduated?
I started. Let's see. I started as an 18-year-old in 1993. I graduated in 2002. So that makes me 28 or 29, I guess.
And what did you major in?
History.
Oh.
With a kind of concentration in constitutional theory and studies.
So you started cooking while you were in college?
Cooking in college because...
To make money?
Well, first, and again, you know, the Elder Band folks were... this is when Food Network was just starting out. In
1984.
Is that when it started?
1993, sorry.
Ah, that's better. Yeah, exactly.
93, 94.
Which is when I entered college, 1993. And if we sort of take an informal sort of viewpoint of the culinary revolution in the U.S., it starts in the 90s, let's just say.
Well, I'm older than you. It really started...
and you have a New York sense point of view, but from the boonies.
From the
Richmond.
From the Richmond, it started in the 90s with the Food Network.
Yeah, exactly, with the Food Network and sushi, you know, being available and all sorts of, you know, there's Afghan cuisine. I didn't even know that existed.
Wow.
You know, but I was learning it quickly because these upperclassmen that I looked up to, you were experimenting around with it. You know, they're doing Thai dishes. You know, one that
cooking or eating.
Cooking.
Oh.
You know, there are marinades. There are interesting Thai dishes. There was, like, I recall learning ants climb trees, was one of them. Yeah, and I tasted fish sauce for the first time.
Yeah.
And so cooking was partially an interest for me, but also it was to impress the co-eds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You're not the first chef to have said that. And so was that the other reason you stayed so long? So did you get a job in a restaurant?
I got a job in a restaurant.
Doing what?
I mean, I was just making, you know, experimenting around cooking at home, and I needed money, and so I applied.
How much money did you have to take student loans? Did your family say you have to pay all of it, half of it?
It's tough for me to remember, but it was easy on me.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to where, you know, they withdrew a lot of support, but they didn't let me just, you know, hang in the breeze, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I was.
So how many hours a week were you working?
35 hours a week.
And doing full load?
And not doing full load. Yeah. Because I actually, I entered college with a whole bunch of AP credit.
And it still took you 9 years?
It still took me 9 years.
Oh, I could understand your parents', you know, frustration.
I could have graduated in 3 if I'd really wanted to. But no.
You were having too good a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too good of a time. And so I would take 2 classes, you know, a semester to finish up. And some you know, semesters.
Well, let's go back to that. You know, in some ways, I don't think that's a bad thing because you have an arc of life. And, you know, there's only one period of your life where you're really footloose and, you know, fancy free. And you can explore different extracurricular activities. And, I mean, I have kids, and I think that the extracurriculars are sometimes more important than the foundation structural courses.
Well, yeah, and my parents and I are able to look at that and laugh now, but it wasn't so funny back then.
When you're paying.
When they're going, what is this idiot doing? You know, he's very talented. He's very smart. And he's just not applying himself.
Did you have ADD? Or?
Oh, yes. I'm well diagnosed.
You know, so many chefs have ADD and maybe are dyslexic a bit. And I don't think that has, you know, I think there's a real benefit to that. There's this curiosity that comes with ADD. You know, learning to focus is important. But people who are too focused, they need a bit more curiosity. And so I've found this very, you know, you were on the right path in some ways.
I recognize now that it's been a benefit to my career. I'm able to hyper-focus on some things, and I'm able to sort of make intuitive, creative leaps in the other because my brain works a little differently.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Where does creativity come from? And it doesn't come from high structure, you know? It takes going outside the lines.
It does. And in some ways, you know, people that came before me, some of my... some of the people I've learned from, Niels Norn in particular, taught me how to think about food.
Was he the VP of culinary when you were here?
He was the VP of culinary when I was here.
Yeah.
And I didn't know it at the time, but I was destined to work for Marcus and for Swedes, you know, for longer than I anticipated.
A dark and brooding group.
Oh, no, no.
Talented.
They're not. They're fun.
Oh, they're fun. But I used to joke with Niels, and I'd say, come on, you know, lighten up, because I can't. I'm a Swede.
No.
You know, I was. But anyway, let's get back to you. So 9 years cooking. When did you start taking cooking seriously?
I finally graduated after kind of cooking my way through at some of the kind of university joints.
Did you do anything at the graduation ceremony that was memorable?
Actually I did. Because I was a reporter, there was this well-known bagel shop in Charlottesville that I believe the summer of my second year I reported on, because I was like the lone news writer left for the summer, as being bought and they're renovating a place on what we call the corner to open up, okay? So this was in 95. So 7 years later, it had been renovated. It was ready to go. But because there was a divorce between the bagel shop owner and his wife, there was kind of a freezing of assets. So
froze the bagels.
they froze the bagel shop. And everyone wants these bagels. This is Bodo's Bagels I'm talking about. And so for 5-6 years of my life, you know, me and thousands of other students would walk past this bagel shop with the little green lights on the cash registers, you know, saying, hey, I'm ready to go. And we can look in there and see there's all the equipment. All they have to do is unlock the door and maybe like turn on the water or something. But for 7 years, it sat there. Probably because of a divorce type thing, as I'm led to believe. And so I carried a big sign that said, I've been here for since you know, 05, and or rather, you know, since 93, and I still can't get a bagel on the corner, you know? And of course, the band wore the silly vests, so I also wore my silly vest covered with buttons of, you know, various ACC victories that we had and whatnot.
Were you happy to graduate, or would you have taken 12 years?
I was happy to graduate, bittersweet in a way, but kind of like you don't want to celebrate your birthday sometimes. So sometimes you don't want to celebrate graduating after 9 years. You'd rather just kind of leave.
So did you
town.
Did you know where you were going to go and what you were going
to
do?
I wanted to use my degrees for something, and I knew I had this great journalism background, and I still wasn't convinced that cooking was a legitimate career. It was never part of my career path that I thought. I thought it was just something, I can play around with, I can do. So I went to tried to apply for some public relations firms because I was sick of reporting the news. I wanted to, you know, make the news. Of course, when I graduated, PR firms weren't hiring, so they said, get your butt over to a political campaign.
Oh.
And so... it wasn't that hard. There was an election on. There's always an election in Virginia. And I just applied to be a campaign intern. And it was actually for Eric Cantor, who used to be a majority leader.
Oh, yeah.
And so I worked on his first congressional reelection campaign. And then from that, I did a statewide attorney general's race. I did a campaign for Rob Simmons up in Connecticut. I did a Philadelphia mayoral race, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
What did you like about that?
Well, I can say now that I hated almost everybody I met. I mean, I was good at convincing people, and I've always been, unlike some chefs, and we can get into this, a people person, and I've learned to use that as an advantage in my career. Mm-hmm. But, and I used that same kind of people skills, intuition in politics, but I just kind of didn't like anybody, you know, that was around politics, because everyone was so gung-ho about everything, and I was just sort of a kind of a, you know, moderate.
Just because they were enthusiastic, or were they
militantly enthusiastic?
And does that mean uncompromising or not being able to see the other side?
Yes, uncompromising and not being able to see the other side. And I always could.
Right. Well, it's called growing, isn't it? I mean, you know, was that a bipartisan observation?
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting. And do you think that the country's even gotten more like that?
I could do a full interview on just sort of what I feel is going on with politics these days, and I blame a lot of echo chamber social media for that. Mm. And that, you know, people only hear what they want to hear. They're convinced that they can get where they're going through, you know, sheer force of will rather than compromise. Mm. And unlike when there used to be more limited media outlets and more vetting of sources, more kind of a gathering of consensus before reporting. Mm. Now it's just a rush to, you know, say whatever the heck you want, and some people are going to believe you. And that's not good for, I don't want to sound elitist, but for low-information voters.
For an enlightened democracy.
Right, or for that.
You need kind of honest reporting on both sides of the issue. But we're going to take a break and come right back.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton reporting from ICC. And actually, you can go to chefstory.com to download this recording if you want to. And today, my guest is Ed Hardy from Washington, D.C., and we're having a very interesting conversation, but we're going to get off politics and get back to how you started your professional career, and you know, because you had politics, you had journalism, you had history, but what drew you into this profession?
There was a campaign that didn't pay me.
Oh.
I was working on a international presidential race for the Democratic Republic of Congo. There was an expatriate named Dr. Oscar Kashala who was running for president at that time.
In the Congo?
In the Congo.
And you were working on that campaign?
And I was working on that campaign.
In the Congo?
that's a movie reference. In the Congo. He was a Boston-based U.S. doctor, and so he was hoping – this doesn't sound reasonable to Americans, but being foreign or from the U.S. in the DRC is not a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, so he thought he had a viable campaign. But unfortunately, he overestimated his fundraising skills and wasn't able to pay me. And all of a sudden, I needed to pay rent. Mm. So it was back to cooking for me.
Mm-hmm. Something. So at that stage, how accomplished a cook were you?
I was a decent line guy. I always had speed, and I went back to work for Illegal Seafoods.
Oh yeah,
On K Street.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was Rich Vellante.
Oh, from Restaurant Associates?
No,
that's Nick Vellante.
I might be mispronouncing his last name, but who was the executive chef of all of Illegal Seafoods at that time.
Yes, he's a graduate. Yeah. Yes, right.
I believe I said it. Right?
Yes, you did. Okay. You did. I was my head was going to Roger Berkowitz, who owns it, but no, that's right.
And so I went back to work for Illegal Seafoods. Well, I went back into cooking. I had to quit politics altogether. Because I had to pay the rent.
And you were up in Boston.
Oh, I was up in D.C. Up in D.C., I'm sorry.
Oh.
Even though the campaign was, for the guy, was up in
Boston.
Boston.
And Legal Seafoods is out of Boston, so. Yeah. Okay.
No, forgivable mistake, but.
Okay.
So I went back into cooking. At that time, I met a young lady who was considering going into cooking school.
Uh-huh.
And so it kind of was a natural move for me to go in, to go work for Legal Seafoods in D.C. and also consider going to French Culinary Institute,
and going which was in New York.
Which was in New York.
You were going to have to leave. So you had already been cooking. Why'd you think you had to go to cooking school then?
That's a good question. And if I would advise myself now, I'd actually say no, because I had several years of pretty good experience, and I would have just gone an internship route. There was sort of a graduate studies money promised me from the ever loving parents.
Oh,
so that became my graduate school, and also the program looked great. it made sense. It was kind of an easy decision at the time.
So did you learn anything?
Yes, I did.
What did you learn?
I can't recall right now.
Okay. Did you have bad habits?
I still have bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the ADHD mind is that I recognize I have bad habits and I just need to employ people around me that are able to help me with keep organized. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I always had was just a load of extra speed. I could memorize 30 tickets on the line. And I wouldn't panic. And mm-hmm. and I would get food in the window.
Yeah.
And so no matter, even if I was working sort of halfway messy, and I don't know if I should bring this up on the air, but I've heard that Marcus wasn't, exactly the cleanest guy back when in the day either. But how can I put it? People always found a reason to employ me.
Right.
Because I always had speed.
So Niels was here when you went to school?
Yes.
All right. And then,
after
school?
After school, during school, I worked for USHG. I was at the Modern, and I was at...
with Gabriel Crutha?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fantastic. And also with Meg Grace, who was an FCI alum herself.
Mm-hmm.
And also, now she owns the Redhead, and I'm sure she's doing wonderful stuff. She's...
Yeah.
Fantastic, and it was great to learn from both her and Gabrielle.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of employed in the mezzanine kitchen, kind mm-hmm. of playing traffic cop for all the operations they have going on there.
Oh,
and just trying to
expediting.
We'd share huge stock pots and stuff,
uh-huh.
and we'd sometimes divide stocks, and then there's family meal that we had to look after for 300 folks.
Uh-huh.
On staff, and then there was the staff. There's the MoMA, staff kitchen as well.
Wow, that's a
so
huge
it's
operation.
So all the loose ends kind of fell to me a little bit.
Uh huh. And so, how long did you stay there?
I stayed there while I was working, while I was in school, so for 9 months. And my biggest regret is leaving USHG.
Why?
Because look at the growth.
Mm.
I could be executive VP of Shake Shack right now if I had made a couple correct moves, but I'm not.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Can you go back?
I tried to several times.
And what happened?
Well, in New York, and also, like, for example, I'll reference the fact that I tried to apply to, the Dynex group a lot.
Mm-hmm. That's Daniel Boulou.
Exactly. Once you have a certain amount of experience, you become unemployable.
Really?
Yes. Because they don't want some guy that that you know has Samuelson experience, and they're going to try to you know make him mm-hmm. into a sous chef, for the Dynex group. They want to promote from within.
Uh huh.
So, you know, once you start working for a guy, you continue working for a guy. Now that might have changed since I've been here, but that was my impression.
It has changed. It has changed.
Yeah.
I think there is such a demand in the industry for trained personnel. I get calls all the time. Got a huge call yesterday for sous chefs. And we said, you know, and we place, you know, I don't know if you talked to Gina here, but we place as many graduates every week as we do people coming out of school. And we have a huge, huge demand for people with 5-10 years experience.
So interesting.
It is, yeah. And I said to the person calling, we don't have any sous chefs. Maybe we have to start thinking about a course to take people, you know, to give them that kind of extra knowledge on what they have to do to be in that leadership position of sous chef.
Yeah, like, order making 101, you know, reorganizing the walk-in
right.
101.
So that's really, you know what? So you went to work for Marcus after that?
I went to work for Marcus after that.
Samuelson, Red Rooster?
Right? Yeah, at Aqua, he was still at Aquavit at the time.
Oh, he was?
Yes.
What was that kitchen like?
And, of course, that was the second incarnation of Aquavit.
Well, I know Neil's. Well, there was an original chef there, and then Marcus became the chef.
Right.
Are you talking about that incarnation?
Right, but then they moved the Aquavit location.
Oh, to another location.
To another location, yeah.
Right.
That was fun. It was half Swedish staff, half Americans. A great amount of female chefs that I have the utmost respect for and are still friends with till this day.
That was great. Was that because that was a Swedish thing, that there was no
gender prejudice,
or was Marcus just empowering?
Well, it was Johan Svensson who was doing the hiring.
I see.
And I have no idea why, but he would hire a fair amount of female chefs. And
did it change the tone of the kitchen?
No, because some of them were like really foul-mouthed.
Okay.
So, but it was a great experience. Swedes were fun to work with. You know, we had milk drinking contests. And
really,
yeah.
What kind? Describe a milk drinking contest for me.
First off, Swedish cuisine is three things. It's herring. Well, four things. Herring, potatoes, milk, and
sugar,
and salmon and dill, whatever.
Oh, salmon and dill. But they sweeten things a lot, too.
Yes, and they sweeten things a lot, too. So you get to learn about mixing sugar and salt, which is and you get to learn about curing and pickling.
Yeah.
Foundations of my cuisine to this day, actually.
Really?
Yes. We had a milk drinking contest, basically, where if you could drink a gallon of milk in under 12 minutes, then you get you win a gallon of herring. I got three quarts in, and I don't want to say what happened after that. It's just not possible.
How many contenders were there?
Oh, about every 2 weeks or so, we'd get a new person in.
Oh, and they
and we'd say, oh, I bet you can drink a gallon of milk. Which makes for great entertainment.
All right. Must be Swiss. I mean, Swedish. All right. So let's get back to your journey on getting to be your own boss.
So I was in New York, and I worked for Marcus. Then, because I was getting married, I wanted to kind of have some time to plan the wedding. So I worked for Restaurant Associates in the ING private dining room.
Oh. How did you like private dining? Was that a 9-to-5 job?
It's kind of like a 9-to-5 job. It's a 7-to-4 job, but it was good. But I needed more excitement, and I knew it from the day I started the job. The money was good, the hours were great, but it just wasn't me. I mean, and having the corporate overlay mm-hmm. of Restaurant Associates, I mean, mm-hmm. they do a great job, mm-hmm. but it's just not me.
Yeah.
I need to express myself. I need to, my dad was his own boss, and maybe it's just in my DNA, but I didn't have tolerance for, people you just obeying the letter of the law and saying, here's a manual, you know, go by the manual and you get rewarded.
Remember, were we talking about the ADD and the creativity and coloring outside the lines and the lack of
All right. Coloring out outside the lines is exactly. So it was a nice interlude, but after I got married, I wanted to leave, that job, and so I left. I worked the appropriate amount of time, I believe 18 months, and I left. And that was when I ran into a hiring problem where I was trying to be, sous chef or lead line cooks for other folks.
How many years out of school were you that time?
Probably about 2 years out of school at that point.
Oh, okay. And so the sous chef was out of your reach at that time?
It wasn't out of my reach. It's just kind of what wasn't in the fit for the groups that I wanted to go to. And, Dynex in particular, I love Danielle Ballou. He's fantastic. But the thing is, Red Rooster was opening, and Marcus was hiring, and I was like, okay, crap, let's do this.
I like it up there.
Oh no,
I
it's like great! It's great up there. It's a great vibe.
Yeah.
It was just interesting mix of people and I love the buzz of the opening too. It taught me a lot about how to manage a brand and how to kind of.
What'd you learn?
Well, first off, I learned a lot about cooking from Nils. But second off, I learned about how to be your own brand from Marcus. Wear the orange colored pants and the funny cap. Be available for interviews. Don't say no to anything. Put yourself out there. Don't be afraid to, how can I put this? Construct an image and go with it.
What did Nils teach you about the cooking on that?
He taught me that, it's got to taste like something, Whatever you do, it's got to taste like something.
He was the most underappreciated chef by the community. He's brilliant.
He's brilliant. He's a genius.
Yeah.
He taught me to keep it simple, stupid.
Uh-huh.
And these are the two rules I tell folks that work in my kitchens. Keep it simple, stupid. It's got to taste like something.
Yes.
Yeah. So
those are two good rules to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And easy to remember.
Yeah. And it's funny because he, I was a great admirer of Dave Arnold and Wiley Dufresne and Cooking Issues and Nils, but I was catching Nils post, fooling around with molecular stuff where it was time.
They
to
did a lot when they were here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was time to rustic stuff up. It's time to just go back to simple flavors.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic, and that influences my food to this day.
Well, actually, that's the arc it should take. I want to make a delicious this, and I will use a molecular or an avant-garde technique, as opposed to I will use the technique to come out with a delicious something. And so it's I think that's the big debate about molecular gastronomy in a lot of ways.
Absolutely, and I fall on
You like the delicious first.
Delicious first.
How do you get there?
Right. If you want to use a technique or two, that's fine. But
right.
But it's about the flavor first.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we got to ask about these trucks and how you got to be your own boss. Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and we're at the ICC in New York City, and my guest is from Washington, D.C., Ed Hardy. Why do I keep that's, everyone thinks, is that the designer? But you're better than the designer. You're Ed Hardy.
I was first page of Google for a while because of my writing, and then he showed up, and I'm slowly clawing back, though.
Do people mistake you all the time?
All the time.
Do they mistake him for you?
Yes.
Have you ever met him?
I know people who know him.
Uh-huh.
And he's actually just a retired like Navy guy. It's not really him that's causing all the trouble. It's a Christian Oettinger who did the Von Dutch as well.
So
it's kind of a designer who takes his name and a couple of his tattoos and runs with him.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so how did you get to be your own boss? And when did you know that's like time?
Well, I've kind of, since square one, I've wanted to be my own boss.
Mm. Is that entrepreneurial or is it just independence?
A little bit of both, because I realize that I'm a skilled chef, but I don't have the skills of some other chefs. You know, some of the bang your head against the wall dedication, and some of the mastery of flavor that other guys do. But what I do have is enough other good qualities and experiences that I and personality where I can use that to my advantage. And possibly, you know, be a chef personality slash brand slash entrepreneur. And I think that's a bit of honest self-assessment that served me well. Because, I mean, here I am.
That's right. Proof is in the pudding. And so where did you start with your own business? How did you finance it? And what were the biggest challenges that you didn't expect?
I'd been saving money for just such an occasion. Well, let's put it this way. The opportunity presented itself. My partner at my last restaurant, Quench, which won a couple awards in Maryland, was selling the business and closing it in anticipation of working on a new project in conjunction with the expansion of the Metro line to Dulles. So this created a couple of plazas and new metro stations, and he was working with one of the developers of the metro station to kind of have a sort of a Grand Central Market sort of thing, you know, where there'd be live entertainment and music and you know, a newspaper stand and coffee shop and 20 other things, you know, all going on top of this metro station. Mm. And his idea that he planted in my head was, well, you know, you should make a food truck and put it right next to the metro station, and I'll make sure you get a sweetheart deal. And I said, that sounds great. And he said, you know, there'll be 17,000 riders walking past your food truck daily. And I said, that sounds wonderful, because if I can capture 1% of them, that means that I'll have more money than I know what to do with. So I made a food truck. I made a food trailer. I invested, call it $20,000 of my own money, and I still owe Dad $20,000.
How did you know how to do it?
I didn't.
Did you buy a food truck fully decked out?
Nope. I bought a trailer. Then I took it to a guy who does know how to do it. And he lined it with steel, and he installed an exhaust and a generator and a water tank and a gas tank. And I sourced the kitchen equipment from various sources. You know, there's eBay, there's Craigslist, there's restaurant stores online, you know, discount shops and whatnot. And I got the equipment, and he knew how to put it in. And, you know, 3-4 months after I started, I have a food trailer that I designed.
So you didn't say, oh, I have this passion to have a food truck, and here, I'm going to make it happen. But it was the business opportunity, and you said, hey, it sounds like a good place to start.
Yes, absolutely. I wanted to go into some kind of entrepreneurial thing. So this seemed like the easiest way to do it, and also the lowest financial risk.
Right.
Was
it?
Yes, because signing a lease for a restaurant means you're in for hundreds of thousands of debt.
Right.
And I'm just not – my dad's an accountant. He just didn't raise me that way.
And you could also sell off the food truck. It was an asset.
You can sell it off as an asset. I could sell it off today. I'd be, be out $2,000 on the whole venture.
Right. So did you have to rethink cooking because of the space and the...
No.
Oh.
Because this food truck is over-equipped. We've got 2 fridges. We've got a sandwich line. We've got a steam table. We've got an oven. We've got a griddle. We've got a grill. We've got a deep fryer. We've got...
Wow.
And space to move around in.
Boy, a lot of chefs don't have that in a restaurant.
Exactly. I joke with my friend Ian, who's at the shack in Stanton. My kitchen's bigger than his. And he's got a restaurant with parking spaces and everything.
That's right. So how did you conceive the menu?
Well, and it's funny. I want to circle back. You know, I thought the food truck moment was gone. Was over. You know,
what year is this?
This is just 2014.
Just 2014.
Yeah, I thought the food truck moment was over. I thought we're on to the next,
right.
You know, big thing. And I certainly thought bacon was over. But I crowdsourced the name.
Bacon's never over.
Yeah, that's what we're learning.
Yes, bacon's never over.
I crowdsourced the name on Facebook, and I got all my creative friends to, you know, submit entries. You know, Ed's discount Crustacular Shrimp Wagon was
not there.
Not there, and Barely Edible wasn't there either. So, you know, Bacon and Ed's it was.
Bacon and Ed's is great. So, one of your friends came up with that?
Yeah, one of my friends came up with that. And so we went with that, and so it's kind of bacon themed, but not really. It's sort of whatever we want to do, and it's kind of breakfast themed, but not really. So we do lunch, we do breakfast, we do dinner. It served us well because.
So you have just the one truck?
Just the one truck.
And how many orders do you put out a day?
At our peak, we'll do 150, 200 a day. But that's at our peak. You know, it averages 100 a day for lunch. And if we're at a brewery or a vineyard or something, maybe we'll go up to 200 people. We'll do weddings. I'm lucky because, unlike other food truck owners, we have a good web presence and a good Google score, and we get calls from people asking us to do events.
Oh, really?
And that's where the real money is.
So, Roy Choi started the real trend, and he was doing, you know, here we'll be. He was taking it around and being at different locations, and it was hip and it was cool. And kimchi tacos. What? You know, tell me about the food. I really don't know the food truck business and what, you know, is being hip and cool where it's at, or just being good and delicious and people know where to find you?
Roy, let's put it this way. I believe in my heart of hearts that L.A. is different.
Mm-hmm.
Because of whatever different zoning or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just it's a different town.
Mm-hmm.
And it already had a food truck culture.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a different beast altogether.
It has a car culture.
It has a car culture. It has a food truck culture. It's got a, you know, driving everywhere culture. It's spread out. Right. Different culture. And same thing. There's a different food truck culture in New York City. There's a different food truck culture in D.C. and Northern Virginia. As far as I can tell. And it all depends upon what local regulations that you're dealing with. And
are you regulated to death?
It feels like we are. And I understand some of the regulations. You can't just have food trucks pulling up to every restaurant and you know.
Yeah, they're complaining that they're paying real estate taxes. And,
exactly.
And well, you must have insurances too.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. And something I want to touch on is that I realize a lot of my colleagues, contemporaries out on the road, at least in D.C., aren't fully up to code. They don't.
How do they get away with it?
I don't know. Probably because there's not that many inspectors. In New York, they wouldn't get away with it because there will be
inspectors.
We're
inspected to death. Yes,
right.
We are.
But, I mean, I carry insurance. I pay my payroll taxes. I have my health permit up to date. I have my fire department.
How many employees do you have?
I have one main kind of protege. His name is Evan.
He
helps me with the web page. He's responsible for a lot of the social media stuff. He's you know, 20 years younger than me. So.
And a good-looking guy, I will say. He's here.
Yeah, he's sitting in the studio with us. And it's great because we're also good friends now.
Good.
He's worked for me for three different restaurants. And that's important to have loyal people, and I try to inspire loyalty.
How different is it? Working from a food truck versus a restaurant?
It's very different.
How so?
Well, you've got direct, you know, contact with the customer. And even if you're sitting at a chef's table, I mean, this is closer than the chef's table.
True.
I mean, the people are literally in your kitchen. They're sticking their heads, you know, into your waist level at your kitchen. You know, it doesn't get more intimate than that. And you sometimes get, you know, instant feedback, whereas you know, in a restaurant, you're not going to get instant feedback. You know, it's going to go from the waiter to the manager to the maitre d' to you or whatever. I mean, they'll say, hey, you know, these fries are terrible, which we don't get a lot of. We get, hey, the sandwich is delicious.
Oh.
So And also, there's weather to contend with. I mean, sometimes it's snowing in your dining room. You know, sometimes the exhaust fan is bringing in snow, you know, into your truck while you're trying to cook. It's very different from restaurant.
Weather must play havoc with your bottom line.
It plays
line.
Havoc because it'll affect your personnel. It'll affect your systems. It affects, you know, how many people are showing up.
Do you just some days close up and not?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've learned that some days it's not worth going out.
Like a hurricane, you wouldn't.
Yeah, hurricane, you don't go out. Blizzards, you don't go out in.
Do you have air conditioning in the truck?
We have air conditioning, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, because the windows open and the heat and the.
Yeah. It's going to get hot in there no matter what. And you're just, but.
Is like, it cold in the winter?
And it's cold in the winter. And the floor gets icy.
That's different.
If it's below 20 degrees, I've learned you just don't open because your battery's going to go, your generator's going to, you know, the viscosity of the oil is going to be, you know, wrong.
Are you all cash?
No. Uh-huh. And in fact, I can mention it, I guess, you know, Square and readers like it very much, is the king of the industry.
Right.
And we probably do 70% credit versus 30% cash almost.
Really?
Yeah.
And what about ordering? Is there any state-of-the-art ordering system?
Some trucks have that, but I don't see
on iPads or something?
Yeah. I don't see the need for that.
Would you ever go back to a restaurant? Do you long for a restaurant?
Oh, yes. The food truck life is not sustainable for me. I mean, I'm getting older.
What are the things you like about the food truck, and why do you want to get back into a kitchen if you do in a restaurant?
I love the food truck. It's nice to be able to, you know, have sunshine on my back and, you know, to kind of, you know, have a drive to a new place as part of my work, but in the long term, it's not sustainable. I mean, I'm inhaling fumes. I'm jacking a trailer, you know, up and down, you know, causing myself probably, you know, repetitive stress injuries. And I've been cooking for a while. And whereas some executive chef jobs allow you to stop cooking, this has me cooking more than I ever have been.
Oh, true.
Because I'm my own dishwasher and my own HR and my own you know lead. Line cook, I'm in my own, you know, fry guy and my own.
Do you have even a seat in the kitchen?
We have a couple stools.
Yeah.
But we never sit. I mean, if we're open, hopefully we are servicing, you know, one or two people a minute, you know, and we're, you know, making money hand over fist. And it's all about, you know, putting the maximum amount of food out in the minimum amount of time.
What hours do you work?
It depends. Last week I worked one shift from 5 to 9, and then I worked a shift from 11 to 1:30, and then I worked a night shift from 5 to 9, and, you know, and sorry, the other was an a.m. shift. I mean, it's wherever people need food and call me, I come.
Right.
And that includes, you know, weddings or office, you know, parties or whatever the case might be. So, which doesn't make, again, for... Yeah, good quality of life because my sleep schedule is screwed up.
Right.
You know, there's no, hey, I can get off work. I'm going to go to the gym and I'm going to go to the gym 4 days a week because that can't be done. I've got to run to the restaurant resupply. I've got to run and get propane. I've got to run and get gas. I've got to.
Does it make sense to have two or three trucks?
It makes sense to have a couple trucks. Yeah. But it also makes more sense for me to, now that I've developed some sort of recognizable brand, to go ahead and get a brick and mortar, because that saves on, you know, the commissary kitchen cost, and that also, you know, allows me to have, you know, more than just two employees.
Yeah, because what do you do on sick? Somebody gets sick.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the larger so you're getting forced to grow.
Yes. If I want to survive, I have to grow. And in fact, I'm sure that a lot of people you've interviewed say, you know, the real profits for a restaurateur starts in the second or third
restaurant. Yeah.
And I'm operating one and I'm making some money, but I'm not making, you know, tons of money.
How important is marketing and PR to you with the truck?
Absolutely important. It's more important than anyone can imagine. And I'm lucky that I have a protege that understands that, but also that I understand it myself.
Right.
And I'm able
to
do social.
And you have to be the PR person, the social media person,
yes.
The car mechanic, the truck mechanic.
Yeah. And everything. Yeah.
Food purveyor.
Yeah. I found out about, you know, batteries and oil viscosity and stuff that I don't know about.
So if your kid wanted to own a food truck, what would you say?
I would tell him absolutely not.
Really?
Yeah. By the way, my kid is named Jacques.
Oh, Jacques.
After his grandfather's Jacques Pepin and Jacques Torres.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I haven't told him that they're grandfathers yet. But.
Oh, my gosh. I was just with them last night. Jacques Torres got the Legion of Honor from the French government. What a great guy.
Fantastic.
Two fabulous guys who have wonderful senses of humor, I will add. So he's probably, if he got your humor gene, you picked the right name. So that's interesting. So you're going to tell little Jacques not to have a, would you tell him he could go in the restaurant business?
If he wants to. I mean, he can do whatever he wants, but I would advise going into the restaurant business. It's a hard business. It's terrible.
So why are you in it?
I'm lucky to have survived. I still have all 10 fingers and toes. I'm not that scarred for some reason. I've let alcohol, have a chance to get its addiction into me because, you know, that's sort of what chefs do. But and I'm lucky. Lucky for me, I just didn't have the brain DNA, you know, to have an addictive personality.
Yeah. Why are you still doing it?
Because it makes people happy, and it makes me happy, and I like talking about food, and people like talking about food, and it's nice to be able to go into a room where I'm surrounded by PhDs and people who work on the Hill and, you know, people who have MDs and JDs, and well, what do you do? Well, I'm a chef. You know, that it's a great feeling, and it's a little just private little joy that I have.
But isn't that, you know, I love the chef community. I really do. I think we have a very special community of nurturers. And I talk to a lot of, you know, students, and they love the concept of family food, you know, in a restaurant. There's a real bonding. It's not just a team. It's not just an office where you have coworkers. I think, you know, in a kitchen, there's something more intimate going on.
Yeah, and I mean, I love the people I work with. Unfortunately, I'm not working with that many people now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I look forward to employing more soon, hopefully, and expanding. And because if I don't expand, I mean, I'm going to wear my body down. Like I said, I've been lucky this, you know, so far.
But don't you think you had to go through that rite of passage before you came?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Everyone has to.
And you have to learn all that, you know, you've learned from Marcus. You've learned from...
Yes.
You know, all your various experiences. And now, you know, you're very well known in D.C. and beyond. Is it easy to get investors if you want to open a bricks and mortar?
Not yet. I feel like I'm just at the tipping point, Dorothy. Mm. I feel like, which is why I love doing interviews like these, I'm getting a lot of good press, but just because you might appear on a Food Network show here or there or you get written a couple nice paragraphs written about you doesn't mean that that translates to money.
Mm.
And I've got a good business sense, and I'm on the lookout for it, but I'm still awaiting angel investors to come, you know, help co-sign a loan for that brick and mortar. But that is just around the corner.
Yeah. Have you done a business plan?
Pretty much. Yeah. I'm in the height of my busy season right now.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. The first year of owning the truck, you know, we made a very, very small profit. This year, we're on pace to double it.
Oh, good.
So, you know, with the business now rolling along, that's a horrible pun. Next year, I'll be able to kind of concentrate on, all right, well, let's...
Okay, so that's a 3-year span per truck. So you'd rather do a bricks and mortar than get a second truck?
It's a good question. How about both?
Not at the same time.
Not at the same time.
Yeah.
No. But, now that I know about the trucking industry, I know where to find a discount truck. Instead of spending, I know some people spend $140,000 on their trucks, which is ridiculous. And I spent $40,000. I've got a great looking truck.
Yeah.
Or a trailer. But, I mean, I know now.
Is it a good way for someone to enter the industry? Because, as you said, you don't have to sign that long lease.
Absolutely
not. You don't have a huge staff.
Absolutely not. Because I was lucky because I knew a bunch of cooking techniques and a bunch of problem-solving techniques that I use every day to solve problems on the truck and produce good food.
Yeah.
And I learned how to produce good food over a course of 12 years of working in very, very, very good restaurants.
Yeah.
So anyone
with no experience.
No experience, they're not going to have all that that 12 years of experience that I learned about problem solving and how to make something taste good, even if you don't have, say, a salamander or something.
Right.
You know?
So, well, we're getting to the end of this interview, which makes me very sad. But I want to ask you a couple of things. What about this Guinness World Record? Tell me about this.
This is unverified, but my secret hobby is that I play trombone for various college bands.
Yeah.
Even though I'm approaching 40, so as a band member, so. I believe I hold the Guinness World Record for most different halftime performances with different bands as a band member. Because I played for Rice, I played for
Stanford.
Are
you allowed to do that?
Dartmouth, I played for UPenn, I played for Yale, I played for UVA.
Are they allowed to have ringers like you in there?
Well, it's a tight little knit community, so you know, once I've done one and done two, I can kind of get some notoriety. And
so you go to the Hill, do you tell them you're a trombone player in a band too?
Yes.
And they're all jealous.
Yes,
I'm sure.
I'm one part chef, one part still trombone player.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Does it score me girls? No. I don't know why. Whatever.
Well, aren't you married now?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm recently divorced.
Oh.
Partly to do with some of the stress of
of
cooking, I think.
Yeah. But you know what? To put it, you know, I'm in New York here, which is a pressure cooker of a city. And, you know, I think a lot of jobs are high pressure. I know what we have in the food industry are very long hours and heat and physical stamina as well. So it's true, but you're still doing it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we were talking earlier about surprises. Finding out something that was, you know, a little more surprising. And so I'm going to ask you, tell me something about you or your working history that nobody knows and could be surprising, that people would be surprised about.
Nothing comes to mind.
How about...
you might have to edit this.
Let's see. We're going to edit this out.
Because the most surprising thing is it was my career in politics and my... You know, I mean,
your background is not the traditional path to
It's not the cooking. Traditional path to cooking.
And also that you weren't so into food when you were a kid.
I wasn't. In fact, Mom will tell you, at one time I was just eating bananas and like rice, and that was it.
And now you're into bacon.
And now I'm curing and smoking my own bacon. I love new food experiences, and I look forward to being able to travel.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have to get a bigger staff for that. That's it. Hey, that was okay. All right. Well. Let me tell you, Ed, it was really great to have you here today. You remembered something?
Yeah,
here?
I remembered something. I am working on The Kitchen, the musical. I'm implying
really?
Finally, yeah. Where on stage will be kind of like the Blue Man Group where, you know, the sous chef enters and starts the
stove. Oh, what
stove
a great idea.
Right, and there's the banging of pots
and
pans.
You may not want to share this. You want me to edit this out? Because you don't want anyone stealing
Dorothy,
it. It's such a good idea.
No. That's okay. It's out there now.
Okay.
If anyone beats me to it, that's fine. But I'm working on it.
All right.
So be warned. I'm bringing it to Broadway, and then I won't have to work
DC's
so hard on the
DC's great off-Broadway to, you know, test it out. So I'll be there next year, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. In between opening the new restaurant.
You get dress rehearsal tickets, absolutely.
Thank you. And thank you today for being on the show and coming up from DC and for doing a demo today for the students here. So
it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And I'd like to thank our producers and to Robin Cohen and Heritage Radio. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.